children, because the last two lines is a very appropriate thing, I think, for us this evening. You know, send us not to staring home, send none unto away. Not just a meaning to us here, but a despair of something that Cooper knew very well. As we will see, I have a picture of him, not a photograph. Some of you may have seen that likeness of William Cooper. Funny sort of white head here to wear. Spelled Cowper, but I'm reliably told to pronounce Cooper. So I'm going to call him Cooper throughout. And it's taken me a while to get used to that. I've had to actually make my note Cooper all the way through in order to make sure that's what I do. He was born in 1741, and he died on the 25th of April, 1800, 217 years and 2 days ago. So he died at this time of year. That timing makes him a contemporary of Charles Wesley and George Whitfield, although 17 years younger than Whitfield and indeed 24 years younger than Wesley. He was a remarkably complex individual. And like all complex Christians, there was much about him that was fascinating. However, also in common with complex Christians, dare I say it, there's much about him that was frustrating. He was incredibly sensitive and incredibly gifted. John Piper, speaking at the Tessian Conference of Pastors in 1992, read a paper entitled Insanity and Spiritual Songs in the Soul of a Saint about William Cooper. And he said this: I want to know why this man struggled with depression and despair almost all his life. I want to try to come to terms with insanity and spiritual songs in the same heart of one whom I think was a saint. Cooper has been described as one of the very greatest of poets, and was easily the most popular English poet of his day. Although he came against that score very late on in his life, indeed, there's one biographer, Faith Cook, who says he was offered the position of poet laureate. He was that good. He's still regarded by people who know about poetry, and I'm not one of them, he's still regarded as one of the very greatest writers of letters, and that certainly is a skill that almost disappeared, I think, off the face of the earth today. He was a wonderful observer of life and nature, as well as being a gifted wit, with an engaging sense of humour. Yet, on occasion, he suffered from deep depression. His spiritual mood seemed to go off the scale of both ends. John Piper said, the battles in this man's soul were of epic proportions. Now, the pairing of thought has been beset by two particular problems, and I crave your understanding for the deficiencies between all these problems, and they are, there is simply too much difference. I've had to wade through as much as I possibly can in the time I've had available, but there's an awful lot about Cooper. And that material is remarkably inconsistent, even on matters of fact. Indeed, much of the material contradicts much of the rest of the material. And even John Piper's conclusion that he struggled with depression and despair almost all of his life, in the first lecture, could well be judged as placing rather too much of an emphasis on the heart empty fact. Let me illustrate something of Cooper's wit and skill. At the age of 61, he wrote this little poem. It's an epitaph on Spot. And Spot was a dog belonging to Lady Throckmorton. This is his epitaph. Though once a puppy, and though Spot by name, here moulders one whose bones some honour claim. No spider man, though a spaniel race, and though no hound, a martyr for the chase. You squirrels, rabbits, leverets of joy, your horns no longer echo to his voice. This record of his fate is not in view. He died worn out in vain pursuit of you. Yet, the indignant shame of Spot replies, and worn with vain pursuit, man also dies. Yeah, it was there. You can almost picture the squibbles and you're there and imagine the thoughts of the animals. Yet, to the turn of the meaning towards the vanity of man. And here we have this mixture of interesting thought and spirituality that's so dearly in Cooper. But I need to start with by opening up the issue of poetry, and particularly Christian poetry. What is poetry? Only for definition. It is an art form in which human language is used for its aesthetic quality in addition to, or instead of, its notional and semantic content. Poems frequently rely for their effects on imagery, word association, and the musical quality of the language used. And if you remember that, if you interpret it, you can understand it, and I'm not doing that. I've often heard poetry referred to as painting with words. If you can understand why people would say that. There's a quality of poetry that in our present age, and especially with our modern things, we can easily miss. Around 75% of the Hebrew Bible was originally written as poetry. This has to mean that well over half of our Bible has originally given poetry. Amazing, isn't it? Why? Why do we do this? Well, one reason may well be that the composition of the poem requires sharper thought. It is massive. And the end result is far superior for reciting, for singing, for memorizing. So there's a good reason why so much of the obsession with poetry. And the word cadence is often used to describe this added dimension to ordinary prose. The Oxford English Dictionary defines cadence as rhythm, measured movement, especially sound. Called voice, especially at the end of period, intonation, close of musical phrase. The word cadenza comes in the same group, the theme. Now, Cooper in his hymns follows a normally accepted rule, meter and rhythm and rhyme, but his more prolific output was blank verse, similar to Shakespeare. This involved equal components of words, but the lack of rigidity provided on scope for feelings and emotions can prove in the poetry. This aspect of poetry being easier to remember than prose is particularly useful in some situations, isn't it? I can well remember poems that I was forced to learn at school. I'm sure we all can. And it's especially so in a hymn. How often it is valid to use hymns in our own devotion. And it's my great sorrow that many hymns that are capable of such use are becoming less and less nowadays. And this is denying the present generation of youth that this store of these wonderful truths in the poems and the hymns in their minds. Some of the phrases contained in Cooper's hymns have become part of our language. You know, it has 33 quotations in the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. I tell you how many Charles Wesley has? 33 for 3. Cooper has 38 citations from one poem in the Oxford English Dictionary. So, wonderful game I invented while I was doing it. Can you spot the hint from one line? See how easy it is to merge in your mind. Don't shout it out with your life. What peaceful hours I went to enjoy. Can a woman's tender care speak towards the heart of death? The dearest idol I have known. Yeah? Lord, it is my chief concern. Have you no words to ask him again? Oh, rend the heavens, come quickly down. The spirit grieves upon the earth. The dying feet is just to see. Sometimes the light can find you. Judge not the Lord by speedy strength. And sinners plunge beneath that flood. The flood may have a bitter taste, but
us.
We could be the plus. You know, we could finish this standard just sticking our money. Here we have a man with a remarkable gift. But more important than that, that man was able to use that gift in the service of God and to enlighten him for future generations. I have 3 points. The first and the last are brief, the middle is the new topic. The first one is just particularly life when you're a Christian. Some of it, so you know where we're going. Then we'll go through his life, picking out six key phases. And then I'll try and draw some conclusions. So you might get something out of this situation, which is incredibly complicated, let me tell you. So in 1731, he was born in Bath, Hampstead, on the 15th of November, the father of the local Christian, son of the local vicar. When he was 6, his brother John was born. His mother died just after childbirth, and only 2 out of 6 potential children lived. So here we have Peter and his 2 sons and no mother when Trudeau was 6. He was then sent out to be a boarder at a school under the headmastership of Dr. Pittman in Market, which was 9 miles away from Barthaston. He developed an eye problem while he was there, and he was severely bullied. Not sure about that. He then went, because of his eye problems, and lived with some optimists in London for 2 years, who were not Christians and had no Christian influence on his life at that stage. And in 1742, at the age of 12, he began at Westminster School. Now, Westminster School is a very famous school and institute for his day. Let me tell you some of the people who went there for their education. Dryden, Locke, with an E on the end. Christopher Wren, Hook, with an E on the end. The composer Purcell, Charles Wesley, Edward Gibbon, A.A. Milne, Winnie the Pooh, Sir Andrew Holt, Sir John Hughes, Kim Philby, Peter Ustinov, both Flanders and Swan, Tony Bates, Andrew Lloyd Webber. See, quite a list of names, isn't it? Of people who have a great deal of skill across a wide range of things, and that's the school he went to in 1742. And in 1748, he was admitted to the Middle Temple to train as a lawyer, and that was a kind of arrangement between the school and the Middle Temple. And he left school for a while then and went back home to live with his father for 9 months. And I think reading between the lines, he sat again at his first bout of depression. He was articled in 1750 at the age of 19 to a Mr. Chapman and spent a lot of time with his cousins. He had 3 female cousins, more of that too, later. He struck up a lifetime friendship with Harriet, who became Lady Hester, one of his cousins, and he had a courtship with Theodora. He was called to the bar in 1754 and founded and a member of the Nonsense Club. His father died in 1756 when he was 25. One of his close friends, William Russell Brown, from the Thames, and he actually separated from Theodora, and he then had the first onset of real. He was admitted to the Inner Temple in 1759 and became Commissioner of Prescott. And at the age of 32, he was offered a significant post in the House of Lords. And he really found that exposed him too much. And he seriously tried to commit suicide in 4 different ways. That is quite interesting when you talk about that too. So he resigned his potential position in the House of Lords and moved into a family called Unwin as a lodger. The man of the family died, thrown off his horse, and he then met John Newton, and he and the man who died on the horse, the widow Mrs. Unwin, moved to a house near to Newton. His brother then died. He then compiled the only hymn book of Newton, many of the hymns that we will know that he wrote. But he then had very serious depression again, and Newton cared for him. He was physically restored and went back to live with Mrs. Unwin, and the only ones were published, which was a great success. Newton then left the area, as it were, and went to London. He then, at the age of 49, wrote his first major poem called Thalassa, or Anti-Thalassa. He had a friendship with Lady Austin. He thought she was going to marry him, but she encouraged him to write more poetry. He wrote about John Gilpin, which is a humorous, light poem. But then he began at the age of 52 his longest, complicated poem called The Past. He began translating Homer, which is a great classic. And The Task was actually published in 1754 and 1785, and he became nationally famous. Here another story by the 10th of the age of 56. Mary Unwin had a stroke when he was 15. She got worse, he wrote home for her, and they moved to Norfolk, Mary died. And he was bereft. He wrote a poem called The Castaway. He died the next year in 1800 and he stayed in the church. And you can see there's a lot of interest in the poem. So he had his bearing bouts and he had his private tents and he had all these things that came and went and he never got married. So the first thing we'll look at more is his parents' childhood. As I said, he was the fourth child. John and Anne. The first three died in infancy, as did the fifth, but his brother, John, born 6 years later, his mother died. His father was a captain in King George II. His grandfather had been a famous judge. Indeed, his grandfather's brother was the first Lord Chancellor of England, Earl Cooper. On his mother's side, he was descended from Henry III and John Dunn, the Puritan poet. So it was a big family of quite important people, and there was wealth there, but as a cross of mine once said about the topic of my company was making, it was opinion fair. His mother died when she was 34 after giving birth to John. Now, whether that had a really big impact on that woman, which is hard to tell at this point in time, but they tried to hide the sight of the Hearst leaving the house with a coffin from his eyes. Nevertheless, he saw it. And he wrote later, "I heard the bell toll on my burial day. I saw the hearse that bore me slow away, and turning from my nursery window drew a long, long sigh and wept a last adieu." In a letter to his friend Joseph Hill, written 4 years after, he wrote that poem. He says this, "I can truly say that not a week passes, perhaps I might equal the rapidity of a day in which I did not think of her. I thought the impression her tenderness made upon me, though the opportunity she had to show me was so short." And the final reflection of that in the hymn, "Heart, My Soul, the Lord," where he says this, "Can a woman's tender care cease to rule the defile she bears?" Feeling there of his affection for his mother and her affection for him. Yes. His father really refused his kiss on the hand, one just a baby, and Cooper himself would have said, "Send him off to boarding school." Now, that seems a bit rough, but maybe it was customary in those days. Well, it was, but it's still quite a separation. And I think he felt it. But he wrote sometimes, I didn't see what he said about the bullying that he endured there. "Here I had hardships of various kinds of conflicting, which I felt more sensitive and supportive of tenderness with which I had been to get at home. But my chief affliction consisted in my being singled out from all the children in school by a lad about 15 years of age as a proper subject upon whom he might let loose the cruelty of his temper. I chose to conceal a particular recital of the many acts of barbarity with which he made his business continually persecuted. It would be sufficient to say that he had, by his savage treatment of him, imprinted such a dread of his very figure upon my mind that I well remember being afraid to lift my eyes upon him higher than his knees, and that I knew him by his shoebuckles better than any other part of his life." So he was very bad and bullied when he was at school. Thankfully, the bullying was expelled, not on after that, though he got his pen out of it. The eye problem meant that he went off to live with his optimist, and then he ended up at Westminster School, which produced a lot of lawyers. It was a very good school for that particular profession. Now, so not surprisingly, we're coming across reading about Cooper. Apparently, he excelled the religious school at cricket and football. And you know, cricket and football. No, that was early in this. So I then looked up the history of cricket and football because these sports were friendly, even though they were. They were quite new, but they were quite seriously played by Cooper in those days. And Cooper apparently excelled at it. And he was very keen on exercise. He walked long distances for people on. At the school, he had a very excellent teacher of classics, and that's why he took a real interest in Latin and some Hebrew. He worked hard, very hard. He ended up as head of his house, and he was ranked third in the academic system. But he had no real awareness of religion, the personal spirit, and he left school at the age of 17. He went back home shortly and then became article in the Middle Temple. But although he was being pushed towards a career in law or indeed in politics, he showed no real enthusiasm for either of these things. And it took him 12 years to get from the Middle Temple to the Inner Temple when he became a fully fledged barrister. But to do that, he had to have a 24 dinners and 6 exams. He just wasn't very keen on it. And his good friend William Haley said about him towards the end of his life, the soul of Cooper had indeed inspired, but fire so refined and ethereal that it could not be expected to shine in the gross atmosphere of worldly contentment. The lawyers have done anything about worldly contentment. This was a time when real sincere was conceived. Now we use the word today as being a job where you actually get paid to do nothing. If in a way it was to be very difficult. But it really existed. And if you had a signature, you legitimately had an income, and you really didn't have to do anything. And these signatures were worth something. They were passed on in families, and they were given to friends, and those were easier. It was one of the reasons that my back had struck your thing. The sort of thing that called an accuser was all inside from God. They really existed. But Cooper had some very useful connections, and he began to cultivate friends from the literary text. He amused himself by translating ancient poets. Horace, for instance, he was very good at translating, and he was a like-minded friend that formed this nonsense club that I mentioned earlier. It was about the same time that he was called to the bar. And this nonsense club was really a dining and talking club. Hoogarth, the artist, a member of this club. Very well connected people there. One biographer says of this time, and you know, having sung this piece of him, and I know what I'm going to say in the rest of the talk, but the sort of man we know Cooper was is really surprising. Cooper was all his life an elegant dresser. He fenced, he went shooting, he danced all night, went to Marylebone Garden, to the Italian Opera, and to the theatre. He could and did drink a considerable amount, and so his early letters show that he's pretty much a young man of society. Then he was quite successful, potential, very bright. He was beginning to write articles at this stage rather than poetry for a magazine called The Connoisseur, which isn't the connoisseur that existed since. There have been a number of magazines called The Connoisseur, and another paper called The St. James's Chronicle. But throughout this whole period, he was quite miserable, kind of lurking in his dreams. He went through what he referred to as George Herbert. George Herbert was a hymn writer and poet that preceded him, who wrote things like, "Teach me my God and King, you know, and all things we see, and let all the world in every corner sing, my God and King." You may well know that. And Cooper said of his Herbert's friends, "I found in them a strange piety which I admired. This was the only author I had any delight in reading." And there's a just a slight strain of inventive quirky within Herbert's work. And you'll probably know this particular stanza. Herbert wrote this: "A man that looks on glass, on it may stay his eye, or it will freeze it to its path.
and then the heavenly fire.
It's quite a kind of rhyming there, which is a lot. But could also describe her as saying that being gossip and untruth. And he was advised by a dear relative that reading her book was far more likely to be questioned further. But always believing in a rather circuitous route towards God, he decided to pray. So this young man is most also a gospel. Right young man, always is gone and always nonsense currently. And he said there's something to rank out in the holy house that we never resort to him, but in the dark, when all creatures have failed to suffer, it might be even satisfied. Even though, after the appearance, as we say, he was enjoying it. And he found himself increasingly taking a Christian point of view when he ended up in an argument with his friends. And he became very aware of his inconsistency within himself. He wasn't a Christian, but he was taking a Christian point of view. But he had lots of time on his hands. Just a few blocks away from his lodging, including three girls, the daughters of his uncle Ashley, his father's brother Ashley. Harriet, who was going to marry later and become Lady Hesketh, Elizabeth, and we don't hear much about her, and the lovely Theodora, the youngest, and we felt the Theodora. And they spent a lot of time together, and with him was his great friend, who was also a friend of his intended, Thurlow, who later became the Lord Chancellor of England. One father who left the point that Cooper was saying was very attractive to him. He was good looking, he was good company, he had good Now, he just spent a lot of time poring over all the different ideas with regard to his relationship with Theodora. But his uncle actually, at this stage, didn't discourage it, but then did discourage it later on. But we can interpret it in a number of ways. It did become officially engaged. But then Ashley decided that they know you can't get married, and you don't know the reason why. But neither of them ever married anyway. So we could say, well, you know, that's unrequited love. What a terrible thing for him to happen so early on in his life. But there is not much evidence that people himself was strongly affected by Theodora. He seems quite happy to have walked away from her at this stage. But he did write a poem. He wrote a lot of poems to her about the sort of media of her. But this is an interesting one about his own view of this period of his life. He says this: William was once a bashful youth with modesty and such, that one might say, to tell the truth, he rather had too much. Some say he was for want of sense, and others want of spirit, so blessed that thing was infinite, while others could not bear it. But some of the different notion had that as each other moved and observed, that only little sense, he pulled it off his senses. However, it happened by degrees, he mended with purpose. The company was more at ease, and dressed a little smarter. Nay, now and then you could look quite gay, as other people do, and sometimes said or tried to say a little thing or two. The eyes are winning, and made free to comment on their shapes, so that there was or seemed to be no fear of that. The women said, and thought he was rough, but now no longer foolish, the creature knew too well enough that wants a view of color. At length, improved from head to heel, was scarce too much to say, the dancing bows so gentil or half so dead are dead. Now that the miracle so strange may not in vain show, let the dear maid who wrought the change in cleansing for her false sorrow. And you think how we must have had him now. But it wasn't what he wanted at all there. Ashley appears to have had influence over free signature in the House of Lords, which was his uncle Ashley, owed to jobs, reading clerk, and clerk of the journal. The reading clerk job was the best, but it required rather too much responsibility for Cooper Brighton, so he decided to go for the clerk of the journal position. Yet, over all his classy enjoyment and promise of advice, he was growing pressure, spiritual pressure. social pressure to economic pressure too. And William was just in time to cope with pressure. So in the end comes the third section of his life, which I call life's not constantly. It's going to get a bit difficult from here on. The death of Sir William Russell, his friend, drowned in pain. The death of his father in 1756. And then there were those around who took exception to the signature arrangement. And the House of Lords decided to interview the applicant at the bar of the house. He was to be allowed 6 months preparation for that appeal and come before the bar of the House of Lords. And all the lords could ask him questions before he could actually take this job. So there he was, young man, good looking, intelligent, a woman prepared to marry him. And that did seem at that stage in the life before the action. He decided on this great little daughter. Now, most biographers are unaware of this, but 7 years later they met her, and she asked him why he was working up. And he said, yes. Oh, yes, I saw the paradise before me, but I also saw the same sword that must forever keep me from it. I don't know if that's enough. He was especially worthy of unceasing worry. Those whose spirit, he said, are for my mind, to whom a public exhibition of themselves on any occasion is mortal poison, may have some idea of the horror of the situation. Others can have none. My continuing misery at length brought on a nervous tremor. Quiet forsook me by day, quiet forsook me by day, and sleep by night. Now, one of Cooper's most recent biographers, a man called Neil Curry, said quite a skeptical stuff about Cooper in a book he called A Revaluation. And I doubt very much that Curry is looking at Cooper as a Christian would look. And it makes his view of Cooper especially interesting. On the flying summary of the book, it says that undeniably one of the great poets of this work shows, Cooper nevertheless sought inspiration using people and resources. Often ruthlessly to that end. He is shown to have had ultimately a highly defensive view of himself to enable him to work and live paradoxically on his own terms. So here we are in 1756, with Fielden Wesley having completed the evangelical continuing in England for a few years. In fact, they were arguably in their prime. And Curry believes that some of Cooper's written rhetoric is influenced by his need to follow an evangelical path. At this point, he uses the term, which I never heard before I read this, rhodomontade, to describe this kind of sanctimonious posting. And, you know, it brought to my mind something that does disturb me more, I think about, in the public testimony. There can be something positive to me. And people can stand up and try to outdo this. And you love to be praised about what I love. Dangerous. And there's an end for it. And then, I'll read you what Curry said about it. Straightforward narrative is defeated by evangelical rhodomontade. And it's difficult to know where the truth lies. A whole new direction is taken. Now came the great temptation, the point to which Satan had all the while been drawing me with his superlative writing. The dark and hellish purpose of self-murder in terms of a conversion narrative. This is quite magnificent, a sin quite unlike any other, and a sin from which you have to be saved by divine providence, but as the events unfold, will become more and more unbelievably melodramatic and fall from the common, and the tone is not helped by the frequent conclusion of such assertions as, thus were the emissaries of the Holy Scriptures. So you can see something in what Curry is saying there, which is right or wrong. I mean, it's up to you to decide. But what happens next when you take it with a pinch of salt or not, we really only have Cooper's words to tell us what happened next. He was obviously a little wet. There's questions about that with this interview coming up before the bar of the house. And he regarded any public appearance as being absolutely just. And he decided a week from the actual day when he was going to have to go through this, he decided to commit suicide. And he received confirmation, he believed at the time, from the Lord that he had heard two men talking about to himself. So, before the marker. So he went out to the tent and bought some laudanum, tried to take it, failed, but kept it around. And on the day before his appearance to have his book, he decided he found himself. He really couldn't bring himself to take the quote. So he got a coach down to Tower Wharf, but when he got there, he found his appointment out. So he had to wade through. He also found that some men watching, and he thought they might rescue him. So he got back in his tent and went back. Tried to take the Lord in when he got home, failed once again. So he got this. So he got out his tent, decided, broke his tent. So he got right, I'll try something else. So he took off his stocking, and with his garter, he made a noose, and put it around his neck, and made it advice that he could put it at a four post of bed. He threw over the top of the bed, and he was going to jump off the bed and dangle from it. So he tried that. He broke the bed first. And he thought, this is no good. It's a comedy, isn't it? This is how you relate it. So he said, I use the door. The door is going to come off, and I can hang it over the door, get on the chair with the seat, and then jump off, take the chair away, that's what he did. His landlady found him unconscious on the floor, but still alive, and he was right. But because of that, he obviously didn't go to the interview at the House of Lords the next day. He describes the state of mind like this, that every stroke my thoughts and expressions became more wild and incoherent. When they ceased, they left nothing but disorder and a confused imagination behind them. All that been made clear was the sense of sin and the expectation of punishment. His friends and family felt that they couldn't see him at this obviously, so they arranged him to go to what is described rather kindly as a kind of madhouse. In the organ run by a doctor Cotton. Tobit is reported as having been those first, and self-harm was never far away, but Cooper himself said that at the time their conviction of sin and expectation of instant judgment never left him. His brother kept trying to tell him he was deluded and that forgiveness was possible, but Cooper didn't mean that. But we now have another strange the two incidents that are rather strange. He found an open Bible twice on a bench in the garden of this private murder. The first time it was an account of the raising of Lazarus. And he was greatly influenced by the gentleness and care that Jesus showed around the place. Then the next time he came across this, that he gave to the it was open in Romans chapter 3. Whom God has set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are passed through the forbearance of God. He says the full beam of the Son of Righteousness shone upon him, and he saw himself pardoned and sealed in Christ's blood. This is 1754, he's now 33 years ago. He was so enthusiastic that he was inquisitive that Dr. Cotton was very suspicious and intended to quote watch on for a further year. He was praying all the time and apparently happy all the time, almost being happy to sleep. His state of mind he described me that I remember the pollution which is in the world and the sad share I had in it myself, and my heart ached at the thought of meeting with him. When he left this private manor house, he took his personal valet with him, St. Robert. The idea of having a personal valet in a manor house quite babbled me. But it took Dr. Cotton some persuading to let him go. They also took a young local drunk, Dick Coleman, with them, but that was rather wrong. His brother secured lodgings for him and St. Robert in company. And Cooper threw himself into his new places, outrageous enthusiasm, that he was less than capable of looking after himself
in the real world, even with a man. The fourth phase then, the light between the age of 34, and it went on right towards the end, right near the end of the 36. The lodgings were proved empty because he met a young man in the church called Will Unwin. Now Will was the son of Maureen and Mary Unwin, and had a sister called Susanna. At this stage, Chris was 34, Mary Unwin was 41, and Maureen Unwin, her husband, 51, 20 years older than her. But the friendship blossomed, that people like the husband and Brown were all very well, and decided to move into their house as a paying lodger, and they welcomed him. And now Mary Unwin becomes a fundamental part of Cooper's life. She was described by one of Cooper's biographers as having an influence greater than that of any other human creature in shaping and colouring his life. This was a complex relationship, clearly. Part mother, part older sister, part fan, but I think we can be certain they were never lovers. She writes this: Mr. Cooper, as he always called him, was always turning my thoughts to matters of religion. This was a blessing to me because my husband, although a minister of the church, was not in sympathy with my recent conversion. He did not believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ or the infinite merits of his suffering. He showed me a horoscope, in this case, that some end of the real concerns now. Cooper provides us with an account of how they spent their average day. 9 to 11 a.m. read scriptures for sermons. 11 to 12 have a service, an hour. 12 to 3, private reading, walking, arriving, or gardening. 3 to tea time, religious conversation and hymns. After tea, a robust walk, and after dinner, hymns, reading of the sermon, and prayer. And Cooper writes to a wife of a cousin. I need not tell you this. Such a life of this is consistent with the utmost cheerfulness. Accordingly, we are all happy and well together in unity with them. Seems fine, doesn't it? But after 18 months, Maureen's horse panicked. The husband of Mary and threw him to the ground in his head. And he has specifically asked Mary not to feel that Cooper should leave if he should die. So they were confronted together by a financial hardship, more houses than this, and the curate from nearby are old John Newton visited them to offer condolences. They got on very well with him, and so they decided to move to Oldham houses arranged for them next door, basically, to where Newton was wanting to live. They arrived there in 1767, and John and Mary Newton accommodated them, so their new home was ready. Now, you will notice I said John was a little curious at home, but this was all that. This is one of those things that, that he had been in the care of Taylor, but there were hardly ever been the other place. But this was a center for good Christians. Henry Venn preached there, Andrew Fuller preached there, William O'Neill preached there, William Hill preached there, John Perry preached, John Lyman preached, and George Whitfield preached. There was also a very good practice in Owen. It was a sylvan place. I have a time to prove that, so I won't take the time to read it to you. But this was a tranquil period in terms of life. But Mary Owen became ill, and Cooper feared she would die and wrote that. Look at this, isn't it? Fascinating. Oh, that I may rejoice to surrender up to the Lord my dearest comfort the moment he shall require me. That's kind of beautiful. And around this time, his hymn writing version again did blossom. He wrote, "Oh, for a closer walk with God, a calm and heavenly flame, a light to shine upon the road that leads me to the land." And he wrote, "The dearest idol I have known, whatever that idol do, you help me to tear it from my throat and get it to you." Mary recovered. And around this time, she sat with his giant brother for a month and 4 days. And became an encourager of his brother, the world group. The fifth period was his friendship with Newton, which really lasted in its fullness the whole time Newton was curate in Ireland, 1765 to 1777. Newton's background, of course, was far better known than Cooper. Drunk, a blasphemer, a womanizer, Norman, deserter, slave, and slaver, and yet ultimately the humble convert of the Christ he had his life. And these two men had such different personalities, meaning without courage and confidence. He offered it to Cooper. But Cooper wrote it to two angels came down from heaven to execute the divine commandment, and one was appointed to conduct an empire, and the other to speak of Sicily. They would feel no inclination to exchange his voice. You know, it's really different from meeting that he felt no difficulty in that situation. Newton's case of living is very hard for people to develop. Indeed, Lady Hesketh noted in some of the letters that I cannot help thinking they might have made better use of a fine summer evening by shutting themselves up to make long prayers. So, as an aside, I'd ask the question, really, is it possible to be too mysterious? There's a question, what did you say then? Is it possible to be too spiritual? You see, Paul says in 1 Timothy 3, we must have a good testimony talking about elders among those who are outside that can fall through the reproach and the snare of the text. We do have the same time mixing with outsiders, living in the world, living well in the world. But, on the other hand, not the big day, there are 6 days when we support in the world, neighbours, Christians, but neighbours or whatever, things our income. So, I'd answer the question I pose. It's not possible to be too spiritual, but it is possible, I think, to get out of balance sometimes in the way we handle things. Newton was no fool, and he saw that Cooper required a challenge. He got into the prayer meeting, and I just thought Cooper was fear and horror in the prayer meeting. He would spend 5 hours training before the start of the meeting, and he brought training to him. And the friendship between these two men blossomed. Both had lost their mothers at young age. Both had fallen in love at a relatively young age. In fact, Newton fell in love with a girl who was 13 when he was a teenager. And after all his blasphemy and all his womanizing and all his comfort of living up, he went back to her and married her, and she became his wife. They had dealings with potential millions in the village. And he wrote a little poem which I love as a description, which of the Antinous Antinomians. The pardon such presume upon, they do not beg, but steal. And when they see it at the throne, aware of the spirit to be. Neat in describes Antinomians as well. Newton had a habit that Cooper didn't have, smoking a pipe. Around this time, Susanna Unwin, the daughter of the Unwins, married. She married another churchman, so Mary and William were left alone to start. And this led to gossip. And Mary writes this, it was not sufficient evidence of virtue for the people of Olney, my son and my son-in-law, both ministers. Likewise, our neighbour and friend John Newton, and that none of them found fault. The perception of scandal surrounding our friendship brought us both so low in spirit. And in autumn 1772, for my sake, we became engaged. The step which had been taken to lessen the gossip only served its purpose. Yes, I mean, I wasn't surprised that it stoked the gossip. And, you know, that period was another difficult period for Cooper. He was so sensitive, these things really affected him. And it may have well been a catalyst for the clouds he so much dread on the horizon, because in 1773, he fell into another deep depression dominated by his fear of his own conscience. At this time he wrote, God moves through experience. Newton wrote about him, my dear friend, still walks in darkness. I can hardly conceive that anyone in a state of grace and favor with God can be in greater distress. And yet no one walks more closely with him or works desperately close to him. In all things. In February, after months of depression, prevailing night. This had a profound impact on her time and the horror of it occurred throughout the rest of his life. Now, the details are sketchy, but the Lord in his night was telling him that he, above all, had no truth. he was undoubtedly convinced that he was lost, alone in the whole of humanity, in that he was both met and lost. He couldn't believe it. He said, well, he couldn't believe in the election then, but that is what he said he believed. They sent the doctor Cotton, he had him in the night out, and he couldn't do anything for him. After months and months, he gradually recovered. He went to stay with the newsman. And when he was there, he began writing the old newsman. And the old newsman was very influential throughout the world, particularly in the USA. And the newsman went away on holiday, and while they were away, insufferable. But that depression healed, and he moved back to live with Mary in the house they called Orchard Farm. Now, again, he comes up with surprises. You might expect him to ruminate and be dismayed, but no, he took up carpentry and gardening. He also threw himself into companionship animals. A dog, rabbit, cat, and three hares. He called best, foot, and tiny. He wrote poems about his pet, including in every part of the poem. That's when he took up artistry and reading travel books. He even started taking his school book and teaching his classes. Then he moved to London in 1737 to a church called Mary Woolnock in Lombard, which is near where it's actually located. There's no doubt that Cooper and Newton were very close friends. They spent a great deal of time together. And there's wide agreement that Cooper was the father of poets and Newton. But there are examples of Cooper's inventiveness in verse being actually criticized by Newton. He thought it would be flourishing. But it was a very mutually beneficial relationship. But the same was not true of the new theorist and Cooper and the general time on his period. So his final phase of life maturity. Since about 20 years of 1780-1800. Having tried many kinds of activity and derived some influence from it, at the age of 50, he felt he still hadn't discovered his true calling. Intellectuals began to write, and it becomes his most productive period, as this requires both stimulus and breakthrough in terms of publication. The hoarding one's talent around publishers is not as easy thing to do. And if you're a very shy, reserved person like people, it's going to be very difficult. But the stimulus came from the fact that Martin McDan, a Christian cousin who had helped Cooper back in 1763, his depression then, he published a book entitled Pellifera or a Treatise on Female Rule. And this book actually outraged the evangelical establishment because it strongly supported polygamy. Claims that it was to do with women on the streets, he started to go, several of them married a Christian man, Martin McDan said it was a good thing, and that outraged a lot of people. So Cooper wrote a poem against that particular view. And Newton eventually got it published. And Mary Unwin saw how that the authorship of that had been good for Cooper. He'd been concentrating on something, so she persuaded him to write more. He blank wrote poetry, and he wrote poems on the progress of terror, 600 lines, truth, table talk, population, hope, charity, conversation, and retirement, all published in 1782 under the title Poems by William Cooper of Jupiter Temple. The mixed response, but soon the originality began to be praised by critics, even though it had been 10 years since his last serious bout of depression, he was beginning to get depressed again. Then he met the Adam Greenberg's book, He Worked at Women, and invited them around to tea the next day. Then he got very worried about meeting tea, very shy. But they came, one was Lady Anna Austin, a widow and an actual evangelical, and a strong friendship was struck up. And it may be that that avoided, helped him avoid depression. In fact, he wrote at that time the diverting history of John Gilpin, of which you may have heard. Now, it may not have said the modern sense of humor, but people then thought that was quite funny. He also wrote a poem, The Nightingale and the Glowworm. Is that just another flavor of how he was? And this is obviously a little bit. A nightingale that all men long had cheered the village with his song, nor yet had he his notes suspended, nor yet had he his eyes offended. He quite appealed as well as he might. This is the demand of happiness. Well, it seems to be around, quite far off upon the ground, as something shining in the dark, and then you glow on by the spark. So scooping down from hawthorn top, he thought to put him in his crop. The worm of Erebus and surrounding that, was eloquent. Think you admire my lamp, quoth he, as much as I your mistress is. I would have thought to do thee. You would have thought to do me wrong as much as I could spoil her phone. For it was the self same power divine taught you to see and need to shine. That you would need it, I would like to make you desire and share this to me. But that's the test of God. Interesting. Contemplation between what happened there. And a glow worm. That was the kind of thing that he used to do. Lady Austin moved into accommodation with the good man's door and began to spend a lot of time with Cooper. And she suggested to him that he settle down to write an even longer poem. And he said, well, you've got something like that. So she said, well, all right, start with that first verse. He wrote, great enthusiasm about the paper, and it was on and on and on, and it became known as the Tart, his most famous poem. It's over 5,000 miles. Not going to be, but it's quite common, it's just so big.